Talk given Friday, 29th April 1977. Child of the immortal light, have you treasured each tear like a pearl in your heart? The voice of one that loves calls incessantly. Come home, beloved, come home by the road of virtue. There is no other way. Let the natural springs of your heart move your feet, unbleeding, on the road of many names. Love and beauty and wisdom and peace and joy. As you walk, you will see the goodness of God fill all the world. Such is the way of virtue. And those who have the book will note that the word virtue is printed in capitals. What is printed in capitals in this book refers to the transcendent aspect of what the word stands for, and not just one of the duals of the ordinary ambivalent aspect which is predominant in our lives. Child of the immortal light. That is what each one of us is really. But that light gets clouded over, hidden from us. And it is our personal responsibility to let that light shine. First, shine in our own darkness. And as and when it shines in our own darkness, unobstructedly, then we who are the children of the immortal light have now become the full-fledged human who radiates light by virtue of his mere existence on this planet. The voice of one that loves first and foremost, the one that loves is within oneself. You know how in Jewish teaching it is shown again and again that the Lord God, Yahweh Elohim, makes a covenant with man. The covenant gets broken. And although the Lord is presented as a thundering, zealous, not jealous in our modern sense of the word, as a thundering, zealous God, is also a God of compassion and mercy, whose mercies never fail. So the Lord makes another covenant with man, and this happens again and again. And that Lord God is Yahweh, immanent in our own being. That is the Lord within us. And it is the lordliness within each one of us, children of the immortal light, that does the forbearing, the infinite forbearing, so that all the wrong that we do must of necessity, somewhere or other, somehow or other, be transformed into the divine good, and therefore the light shines unobstructedly. And the voice of that one that loves calls incessantly. How often within ourselves, in our everyday life, we are moved strongly, deeply moved to tears, or so moved that the body shakes because of being moved that way. When we hear something, when we remember something, see something, and so on, why does that happen to the body? Because the voice of that one that loves is being heard. Even if we do not know with the brain that that voice is speaking. Come home by the road of virtue. This virtue, which is spelt in capitals, this transcendent virtue, means strength above all. Its source is the omnipotence of the creative power that releases cosmos out of primordial chaos, maintains cosmos, and brings it to fruition ultimately. This is virtue. In other terms, not our dualistic terms within the ambivalent sphere, but in our terms as full-fledged humans, because our virtue is a cup which is rather small, and it cannot contain the virtue of the total, whole, creative power. But for us, we have to translate it as virtue in the transcendent sense. Come home by the road of virtue. There is no other way. And if this virtue in us is the reflection of that omnipotent power, then obviously this is our capital, our material, our dynamic, which moves us forward in such a manner that we do grow into our full-fledged humanness. Let the natural springs of your heart move your feet, unbleeding. You know how all the mystics and religious teachers have talked of the sharpness of the way. It makes one's feet bleed. That is because we are moved by forces which are not virtue in transcendence, in the transcendent sense. This pure virtue, which is utter purity. And this movement in terms of utter purity knows no thorns or flints which make our feet bleed. So, one treads an upper air, so to say. I'm using the term upper air metaphorically. For in these deep realms into which you and I can enter, there is, as the Buddha pointed out again and again through the discourses, there is rapture, there is happiness, culminating in peace and perfect equanimity. And there can be no bleeding there, there is no sorrow there. Be careful not to misinterpret that last statement. There is no sorrow there. The sorrow of our own making through our ignorance and through our incapacity to live the holy life, to tread the path, to walk in the way of the Brahmacharya perfectly. So let the natural springs of your heart. However wicked a man may be, however much he may have crushed the true nature of his own mind and heart, his soul, to use a simple word, distorted it, made it poisonous, those natural springs still work, even if ineffectively throughout his whole life. But they work. Because man's mind, his psyche and his heart is constituted of those urges. So the natural, let the natural springs of your heart move your feet unbleeding. So one moves into the religious life spontaneously, naturally, because one can't help it. One doesn't even know that one is living religiously. Self-conscious virtue has ceased to be a living, dynamic power within one. It has become a rag with which we wrap ourselves. That is self-conscious virtue. That is one of the, perhaps one of the deep reasons lying behind Krishnamurti's constant statement, you cannot cultivate virtue. It becomes a self-conscious other thing than ourselves, which we put upon us to make a show to the world. The road of many names, love, beauty, wisdom, peace, joy. Just words which are sounds to stimulate the natural springs of our hearts. Those words do not apply where virtue in its own transcendent reality is concerned. But it is necessary to have something at work which draws out of us a true response, not a mere reaction. There's a tremendous difference between them, a gulf which cannot be bridged. The ordinary reactiveness with which we function in life is not true response. So when the natural springs of our heart are drawn out by the power of transcendent virtue, the sound which it makes, the song which virtue sings, has only these words in our human languages to express them. That is why they have to be used. But their meaning is utterly transcendent. Don't try to lift the veil on that meaning, desiring to know the meaning, because you'll never be able to lift that veil, and you'll never know by means of the brain. You can only be that transcendent love and beauty, and so on. As you walk, you will see the goodness of God fill all the world. So if we live by that virtue, all that we see and hear and experience around us in our everyday life as pain and misery, horror and evil, which is literally rolling like an irresistible flood over this whole earth now, you will see the goodness of God filling all the world. Don't seek an explanation, an intellectual explanation of that statement. Don't believe it because it is written in this book or said by me or anybody else. But just let virtue flood your being without your knowing it, and you will become aware of that goodness. Primarily because you yourself have become that goodness. You know that marvelous phrase the Buddha uses, which scholars in the past did not translate correctly, literally. the literal translation is the correct one. But people like Ananda Kumaraswamy, Isalin Hona, and others have translated it literally. The Buddha said, make become the great virtues, etc. To make become the pure state, the harmless state, and so forth. Meaning, let that which is inherent naturally come out through us, because we have ceased to obstruct it through our perfect mindfulness and our quietness and equanimity. Make become the goodness of God. Such is the way of virtue. This beauty is something which is quite extraordinary. When there is this perfect mindfulness which cleanses and heals, then one hears the song of life wheresoever one is. One sees the plenitude that fills the void with silent eternity. Why be in sorrow when bliss throbs through all? Let the whole heart be virtue, and sorrow will be a spent dream, and the body's ache leave no scar. Behold beauty, your own beauty. For the beauty of the morning star that holds the lone sky in solitary splendor, the loveliness of the rose and the sweetness of the song of the bird in ecstasy, is you yourself, the face of eternal beauty, not to be seen in a mirror, the face that is everywhere, shining, smiling, sustaining, serene. This is nothing original, really, as written in this book. Here is something from the Rig Veda, and it is pretty ancient. It is at least 4,000 years old. This book has just passed its first birthday, the book from which I read. Now, the Rig Veda, this is a hymn to Varuna, the lord of virtue. He is the moral governor of the universe, Varuna. Varuna, I'm going to read just a little bit because it's a long hymn. Varuna, king of hallowed might, strength, power, sustaineth erect the tree's stem in the baseless region. Its rays, whose root is high above, stream downward. Deep may they sink within us and be hidden. Incidentally, I might say that in both my books, the quotations are not written merely for support of what has been said by the writer himself, but they are intended to be meditated upon, to be used. Otherwise, one just turns the pages over, says, oh, some more quotations, and turns the pages over. Do that and you'll miss some of the real value of the book. Varuna, king, virtue, of hallowed, sacred might, power. And this is the only power that is sacred, because all other power, until there is the harmony of love and wisdom in love and wisdom in perfection, is inevitably and invariably misused and produces sorrow and death, which is destruction. King of hallowed might, sustaineth erect the tree's stem in the baseless region. What is this tree which virtue sustains? Universally speaking, it is the tree of life. The whole cosmos itself, and all the life that functions through it, that thrills and throbs through it, maintains it, nurtures it, nourishes it, changes it, transforms it from one state of beauty and perfection and cosmic order into the next state. This is the tree. The tree's stem in the baseless region. Cosmically, the baseless region is the void. That emptiness, which is not vacuity, an absolute nothingness, but which is no separate, identifiable entity, a particular thing. That void which was never born, which is undying, sorrowless, stainless, perfect, utterly transparent to the immortal light. Its rays, it's strange to talk of rays with respect to a tree, isn't it? But that's the word used in the Rig Veda. Its rays, whose root is high above. High above. There is no pinpointing the zenith. It is infinite. It is nowhere, which, as far as the English language is concerned, by a trick of changing the accent, is now here. But that is the fact. And the now here is the infinite nowhere. Because that which is transcendent is immeasurable. We cannot grasp it. One of the profoundest reasons why the Buddha taught that the cessation from all grasping is nirvana. Its rays, whose root is high above, stream downward. Deep may they sink within us and be hidden. What an astonishing thing to say. Now that cosmic tree is reflected in the tree of life within our own bodies. And this primordial chaos in which was planted the Garden of Eden. This body, this psychophysical organism is the Garden of Eden. And the tree of life within our own bodies, the brain and the nervous system and the spine and so forth, comes downwards. Because the brain is the root. And from the root, from the brain, which is a material physical root, solid, liquid matter, from the brain, there are stream upwards, invisible radiating energies and forces towards the zenith. Our response to that which pours downwards from the infinite cosmic tree . If you can be really mindful when you are by yourself, particularly in nature, and especially near trees, you can actually feel this. You will find one reference to that sort of experiencing in that book, The Heart of Religion. Deep may these rays sink within us and be hidden. They are not for display. They work from within outwards. The power behind the visible throne. Think carefully of these things. The greater part of our life is an invisible process, intangible. It is unknown to us. As we are at present, we are unconscious of it. But when there is perfect mindfulness, we won't become conscious in the ordinary sense of discriminative consciousness, vijnana, but we become aware of it because awareness and being in that total, complete, transcendent sense is one and the same thing. This is something that theistic theologians have almost never penetrated. The great mystics have. Whether they belong to a theistic or a non-theistic following. King Varuna, back we go to the Lord of Virtue, transcendent power, hath made a spacious pathway, a pathway for the sun wherein to travel. S-U-N, sun. Where no way was, he made him set his footstep and warned afar whatever afflicts the spirit. King Varuna hath made a spacious pathway, a pathway for the sun wherein to travel. The physical cosmic reference, of course, is to the sun, the sun in our solar system. But that is of little importance to us in this connection. Because remember, scripture deals fundamentally with what happens to you and me in terms of consciousness and its transformation. The sun refers to that energy which the yogis associate with what is called the Pingala Nadi. Nadi's channel. At the base of the spine, the two nadis, Pingala and Ida. Pingala is the solar channel for the solar energies, and Ida for the lunar energies. And you know, they go around like that. But the sun is the great enlightener, just as the moon is also the great enlightener. But the sun is a force which brings into manifestation, which sustains manifestation and outward life, and also acts sometimes maleficially. The sun is a malefic planet under certain conditions. But don't mistranslate the word malefic in this context. The sun breaks up, destroys. Destroys is a bad word, but I'm going to use it and point to the fact that that which is where life has expended itself, and there is a corpse or death, the sun or excreta or whatever it is the sun which transforms it all into something useful later on. So in that sense, it destroys. And in that sense, the solar energies within the body do the work of destruction, especially psychically. These are deep things. And these things have never found proper explanation even a suggestion of how to approach them and understand them. Sri Aurobindo in his books has done a great deal in the early part of this century, those four fateful years between seven fateful years between 1914 and 1921, when he produced some quite remarkable stuff, he was, I think, the first to bring these things out openly. But this is something I'm pretty certain he has not done. So, this is the way we have to understand these things. So you see the place and importance of virtue. I think I have just time to touch upon how the Buddha presents it. Perhaps it would be simpler to say, study that long discourse in the Digha, the Brahmajala Sutta, about the third page, from the third page onwards of that sutta. He talks in the third person about himself and expounds the minor details of mere morality, as he calls them. Now, here we have, in the Rig Veda and so forth, we have positive statements, as we would commonly say. The Buddha presents the more practical, gives the more practical presentation. The positive statements about transcendence and so on, we don't know. We don't know what transcendent love is or wisdom. But we do know what anger and hate and jealousy and stealing and self-indulgence, food, drink, and all our sensuous pleasures to which we never say no when we are invited or asked or etc., etc., and which we pursue relentlessly throughout our lives and destroy the psychophysical organism thereby. All this we know. And the Buddha just points out quietly, undertake the course of training to abstain from such things. Now, if we don't abstain from such things and practice constant mindfulness with respect to them, the words of Jesus apply to us. You know how he talks to the Jews and calls them, ye hypocrites. And he says something stronger, and vipers. Because the Jews, in being hypocritical that way, were naturally poisonous in their reaction to the people. In the Sermon on the Mount, he refers to such people as dogs and swine, and expressly forbids giving that which is holy unto the dogs, or casting pearls before swine, lest they trample upon them and turn round and rend you. Even in modern times, this kind of thing happens. Look at the totalitarian countries and their behavior, where religion is concerned, and the religious life. So, be wise, become virtue, and realize, let each one of us realize that he or she is the child of the immortal light.